Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From day one, it was a revolutionary idea.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
Music videos, 24/7 on cable TV. What a concept. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we look at those heady first 10 years of MTV. We'll hear from the co-author of a new book about the network, and we'll talk with the executive who created it. Later, sax player and composer Rudrish Mahanthappa has long drawn on his dual influences of American jazz and South Indian classical music. Now, a hint of electronica is creeping into his new project called Samdi. He and his band will play live. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. This is an encore edition of Soundcheck. Video killed the radio star, and MTV was the scene of the crime. This is Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer, and today we chart the rise of the network that brought pop stars like Michael Jackson and Madonna into the world's living rooms. Plus, a live performance from sax player and composer Rudrish Mahanthappa and his band. But to begin, MTV premiered at midnight on August 1st, 1981, with the airing of this music video. Video killed the radio star by the British new wave group, The Buggles. The 24-hour channel dragged the music industry into the age of the music video, and then a decade later, began to leave its video bread and butter behind. In a moment, we'll talk with someone who was present at the birth of MTV, but first I'm joined by Rob Tannenbaum, who along with Craig Marks is co-author of a new book called simply, I Want My MTV. Rob, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
Some quotes from your book. We fed Valium to a few cats and had them running around a table.
Yeah.
I was on constant nipple patrol. Girls belong in cages. Yeah. Your book is a series of kind of linked quotes, one after another. It's told as an oral history.
Yeah.
Why choose that approach?
There have been books that have been written before about MTV, but they tended to interview the same 20 people over and over again. And what we wanted to write was a book that would include not only those people. We also wanted to talk to the woman who played the teacher in the Van Halen Hot for Teacher video, because she's an important part of the video industry. Mm-hmm. So we ended up interviewing more than 400 people for this book, and we wanted everybody to have an equal opportunity to say something interesting about giving drugs to cats.
And a few people took you up on that.
They did, thankfully.
So the book covers that golden era for MTV.
Yeah.
From the beginning, August 1st, 1981 to 1982. Is this the story, 1992, is this the story of, the TV version of the little engine that could?
It is. If you had gone back to 1981 and asked your stockbroker, should I invest in MTV, he would have said, absolutely not. This thing is never going to get off the ground. And it's easy to forget this now. MTV is a global brand,
mm-hmm.
150 channels across the world. But the cable industry didn't want anything to do with it. The music business didn't. And even the advertising industry thought that it was a bad idea.
The idea, and we can get to sort of the vision of MTV in a moment, but the idea of music videos precedes MTV.
Absolutely. Although the term music video didn't exist even in 1981. When MTV was going around pitching themselves to record companies, there was no real phrase they could use to describe what they were going to do. But there were little films of musicians playing, at least back to the 1930s. There were these things called scopatones that a lot of jazz musicians put together. Elvis Presley arguably was making videos in the form of films.
Mm-hmm.
The Beatles did. The Rolling Stones did. So this was not unprecedented, but no one else had made an industry out of it.
Right. I can remember, as a kid working at, my school radio station, going to, the offices of what was then, I guess, Columbia Records and is now Sony, or Polydor, and being shown little films. They were just called promos.
Yeah.
And basically it was the song with people acting, or occasionally you just have a band kind of lip-syncing to the song. And these things could really make or break a record. In 1975, Queen made a film for Bohemian Rhapsody that got lots of airplay on the UK show Top of the Pops. Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody stayed at number one on the pop charts for weeks in 1975, boosted by the fact that this little film appeared on the TV show Top of the Pops. And Rob, it was basically, they didn't want to have to trek down to the studio and schlub all their gear and play live. So just make a film and let people play it.
In England, when you had the number one song in the country, you had to go on the TV show Top of the Pops and play the song. And at that point, Queen were just like, ugh, we can't be bothered. Another number one hit, yawn. Let's just send them a video. So they made this thing in about 3 hours. The guy who directed it said, we started in the early evening and we were at the pub by 10 p.m.
So there is a precedent for the idea of music performances captured on some kind of film. Whose idea was MTV?
Over the years, a lot of people have claimed to have been the father of MTV. It's so successful now that people want to claim a part of it. But really, there's one guy who deserves the credit, and that's John Lack.
And joining us on the phone from Florida is that very same John Lack, who created MTV as the executive vice president for what was then known as Warner Amex Satellite Entertainment Company in the early 80s. John, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So it seems like, you know, there were these videos, whatever people were calling them, promos or films. What was your idea for MTV? What was the twist that you put on it?
Well, I had seen these things that Rob mentioned, these videos in Europe, Top of the Pops. There was a show on TF in France. Because remember, in Europe in the 70s and 80s, there was no radio like we had in America. Their radio was state-sponsored or country-sponsored, mm-hmm. BBC 1 and 2. So music wasn't played on the radio to promote itself the way way it was done in America. And as Rob said, you had to be on one of these one of these music shows to play your music, and then you played it, and you know the record store sales went through the roof the next morning. And we had just developed in America these whole new transponder satellite positions that enabled television to have a whole bunch more channels. And my charter at Warner Amex Satellite Entertainment Company, that mouthful you mentioned, was to do specialized audience entertainment. What had happened in the magazine business, what had happened in the radio business, was now about to happen in television. And the first of those channels, of course, was HBO, which was uncut, unedited movies without commercials. And then there was news radio on television and CNN. There was kind of the sports nobody wanted at the time, which was ESPN, All Sports.
A lot of Australian rules football, as I recall.
Indeed. And we had first done at Warner when I got there, the movie channel. The movie channel really was an outgrowth of what was then on Warner Amex's own cable system, Star Channel, and we took it 24 hours and went all movies because that's what the research said people wanted and would pay for. And then we took some children's program we had in Columbus, Ohio, and put it up on another satellite transponder, and it became Nickelodeon. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it was just kind of pro-social, non-sexist kids entertainment for franchise.
That didn't last long.
No, it didn't. Much to the happiness of Viacom, which now owns it, of course.
So,
and the third thing we had on the drawing board, which was my dream, I was kind of always wanted to be a rock and roller, and I was running a news radio station when my friends were running rock stations, so the dream to do a rock and roll television station had always been in the back of my mind. And when Schneider and I went to Warner, Jack being the president of Warner Amex Satellite, I said, look, we've got to do music third, and then we're going to do shopping, and then we're going to do games. And we had five or six of them on the drawing board at the time.
And how hard a sell was this?
Well, it wasn't as hard as we thought, actually. We all got a little excited about it because we had a partner in Warner Amex of American Express. And they certainly weren't into rock and roll and these young kids, and that kind of stuff was not, you know, part of their business. And yet they believed that what we were doing at Cube in Columbus, this interactive stuff and music and soon interactive music was something that they ought to invest in. So they said yes quicker than Warner did. Warner, obviously, being in the music business and the television and the movie business, you'd have thought it was an easy one. But Steve Ross had his reservations about would they watch it over and over again, and
yeah,
are there enough clips, and will we get them for free? You know, all the business decisions that you have to think about before you invest $25 to $50 million.
This is one of the, to me, this is one of the interesting things about the story. You know, John, it gets repeated in the music industry every time some new kind of technology, we saw it with digital, where the industry has to be dragged kicking and screaming into thinking that this is not going to kill you. This is going to help you. You know, did you get a lot of pushback from the record companies when you said, we are going to take your promo videos and we are going to play them constantly for you?
And we're going to sell music,
yeah,
which is what happened. But, you know, they're always naysayers. They're always guys who jump on the bus first. Of course, we had Warner. They were one of our parents. And we convinced Columbia fairly easily because they and Warner had many deals together and they understood it. But PolyGram and Arista and some of the others took their time because they didn't see it. And then, as Rob knows, they would have had to make videos, which cost them a little bit of money, and they weren't prepared to do that until they saw a successful distribution system.
All right. Let me read you a comment that Jonathan has posted on our Facebook page. I grew up in a rural region of North Carolina, so we didn't have cable TV until 1989. Prior to that, the only way to watch MTV was when I was hanging out with my friends at their homes. Distribution, the idea that you had to get people to call their cable providers and say, I want my MTV. You
know? And it was that famous campaign, I think, that made a big difference in gaining us that distribution. Remember, we weren't on in New York in the beginning. We weren't on in Los Angeles or Houston or Detroit or Chicago because those areas were just being wired with these big cable systems at the time. So those rural communities did come first. And it took us a while, and that campaign made a big difference. We spent some money and took a big risk, but it worked.
It not only worked, it became a sort of iconic campaign. I want my MTV. Here's one of those ads from 1982 with Pete Townsend of The Who, Pat Benatar, and Adam Ant.
America, demand your MTV. I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
MTV, music, television, video, music, 24 hours a day, and it's stereo.
Oh, baby.
Call your cable company and say, I want my MTV.
I want my MTV. Rob, it was, you know, it was a cry heard around the country. How important was it for people like Jonathan growing up in North Carolina to have access to the same kind of music programming that people eventually in the bigger cities had, too?
Well, the rural areas got MTV before the cities did. It was a simple financial reason for that. It was cheaper cost per mile to lay cable in the suburbs. And if you think about it, the suburbs needed it more. You know, kids in Manhattan had access to culture. They had access to alternative music. If you lived in Ohio, you were listening to a radio station that in 1981 was playing the exact same songs they'd been playing in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
So you turned on MTV in 81 and you could see A Flock of Seagulls, Duran Duran, ABC, Haircut 100, all these wacky British bands who, you know, with guys wearing lipstick. And that had a big effect on the Midwest.
Rob Tannenbaum is co-author of the brand new book, I Want My MTV. John Lack is currently chief partner at the digital media company Fire Media Partners. But back in the early 80s, he created MTV. It was his version, his vision, rather, as executive vice president of the company that was then known as Warner Amex Satellite Entertainment. And John, it seems like your idea of video radio, you went so far as to hire a lot of people who had radio experience, but not a whole lot of TV experience. And that seems to have led to a bit of a, shall we say, a rock and roll atmosphere there in the studios.
Well, it did. That wasn't the intent at the time. But these guys, Pittman and Sykes and Garland and McGroarty, who all came out of the radio business, because radio was something that this format was going to be more like than it was television as we knew it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and remember, we looked at the world and said, there's a soundtrack, and then the picture will follow the soundtrack. Most of television wasn't made that way when we came along. It was just the opposite.
Yeah.
There was television, and then they put a music bed below it or something. So we looked at the world the way we thought it should be and programmed it the way people would listen to it and then for watch it. So if you like this Eagles song, will you like Pat Benatar or will you like Duran Duran better next?
Mm-hmm.
So it was all about that. And Bob Pittman, who was the best hire I ever made, understood this and programmed radio stations with that kind of research in mind.
Now, one of the things that that Rob and his co-author Craig Marks do in the book is, you know, a lot of these people, yourself included, John, speak pretty frankly about things that were going on there. And basically, by the end of 1983, you had been forced out of the channel. You're quoted as saying, "When you're playing in big boy land, the air gets kind of thin at the top. I learned that you can't stay too long at the party when the party's over for you." Having sort of set the channel out on its direction, did it go where you thought it would, or did it kind of take a left turn somewhere?
Well, it only took a left turn, I think, when Rob ends this book, when MTV left the world of music for the world of pop television, mm-hmm. for lifestyle television, for reality television. And they did that, as you might understand it, because the ratings were bigger with those kinds of programs than they were with music at that point. But the culture that we lived and the culture we loved, you know, Bob Dylan was our poet. He wasn't just a musician. You know, when the Eagles said, "You better let somebody love you before it's too late," these were our mantras. And so the lifestyle that these musicians had and the way they partied, you know, we kind of played that game too, because it was all about them. It was all about the music. And I guess the stuff that was peripheral to it was something that we had some fun with as well.
But, John, the guys you hire, the guys you were working with, they were out late drinking shots of tequila, doing drugs, coming in at 10 in the morning. Your staff were like rock stars.
but they worked their tails off. Mm. We, you know, we said we'd put this channel on the air in 7 months. Can you imagine putting a television network on the air in 7 months? And we did it. And we did it by breaking glass and breaking the rules and telling people we could do it even if they didn't believe we could. And that's why this was a Camelot. I mean, this is why this book that Rob has written is so interesting, because it was about that time and it was about that thrill of doing something so completely different.
That time was 1981 to approximately 1992, and the book is called I Want My MTV by Rob Tannenbaum and Craig Marks. Rob's with us here in the studio. We've been speaking with John Lack, who started MTV back when he was with Warner Amex back in 1981. And John, great speaking with you. Thanks so much for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Pleasure.
In a moment, we'll hear more of how videos became a focal point for record labels and for many of us. We'll take your calls and your comments. MTV helped launch superstar careers like Madonna's. In a moment, we continue our look at the golden age of MTV with your calls and comments, and then later, a live performance in the studio from a band led by sax player and composer Rudrish Mahanthapa. This is Soundcheck. You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with Rob Tannenbaum, the co-author of the new book, I Want My MTV. And in the background, you're hearing Michael Jackson's Thriller. The video was played so often on MTV that the channel would actually run a countdown clock to show how many minutes it would be until the video aired again. But not long before it premiered in 1983, Michael Jackson's videos weren't shown on MTV at all. And Rob, the whole question of a kind of latent or, you know, obvious racism in the early years of MTV is something that, again, comes up as people reflect on these years. Was it set out to be a rock and roll channel only?
The guys who programmed MTV had come from the world of radio, and radio was very segregated, still is largely. If you played white musicians, you mostly didn't play black musicians. And that was the analogy that MTV began with. We're going to be a rock television station. Now, it just so happens that their definition of rock was music made by white people, by and large. Mm. There were a few black artists on MTV, but not very many. And people understood this sort of until the British bands came along. There was a band like ABC who was British, and they weren't playing rock and roll. They were playing R&B music. So there were people even at MTV who said, well, wait a minute. If we're playing white people playing R&B music, why can't we play black people playing R&B music?
So how important was Michael Jackson in integrating MTV?
Oh, absolutely crucial. And not just in integrating MTV, but in ensuring the future success of MTV. When the Thriller video comes out in December of 1983, MTV has been on the air for more than 2 years. They've burned through at least $50 million, which was a lot more than had been budgeted. And they were probably about a bad quarter away from going out of business. If it weren't for the success of Michael Jackson, MTV might have died about 2 or 3 years after its launch.
It's an amazing story, and it seems like everybody has their own version of it to tell. So let's go to some of the calls on the line, beginning right here in New York. Robin's with us in Brooklyn. Hi, Robin.
Hi, John.
What do you remember of those early MTV days?
Well, since I was a young child, first grade, I used to listen to Bruce Morrow, and I was a real radio addict. And,
Bruce Morrow on the WABC radio, strong AM signal here in New York.
That's right. And then around the time of MTV, I had just graduated college and moved into my own apartment and didn't really listen to radio anymore, but really loved MTV. And it was a way that I kept current in terms of, you know, the artists that were performing. And it was great to see what they looked like. And it informed my nightlife because I would go to clubs that would tend to play some of the songs that I heard on MTV. At that time, primarily the Peppermint Lounge was one of those places.
Right.
One thing I wanted to ask is I remember when I was also a child, somewhere around like 1967, 68, there was a show on WPIX or WOR-TV that was called Now Explosion, and it was primarily psychedelic kind of music videos. No one seems to remember that show, so I was just wondering, and it didn't last very long. My father forbade me from watching it because he thought it was a bunch of drug-induced hippies.
He was probably right.
Now Explosion was the name of the... So that's... whether it's WOR or WPIX, that would have been a local New York City show. So there were like little pockets of this here and there prior to MTV.
There was a program in Australia, another one in New Zealand, even on NBC TV in New York in the late 70s. There was briefly a show hosted by Bob Pittman that showed a couple of music videos once a week.
Right. Bob Pittman, another of the key players in the early years of MTV. Rich is on the line with us from Baldwin, Long Island. Rich, this was a cable thing, and I understand you actually worked in the cable industry back then?
Yeah, I was working in a local small cable company that before they got swallowed up by Cablevision. And the MTV phenomenon in 1982, 83, 84 was just unbelievable. It was just exploding. And the big selling point was getting people to get the adapter to allow them to hook up their stereos to their TVs, because TVs weren't stereo capable in that era. And it was just starting to, it was a nascent technology, but the stereo hookup was the hook for people TV.
You know, Rich, I had completely forgotten about that. But Rob, that you know, that was something that you had to do back in those days.
And MTV,
wanted stereo sound,
yeah, MTV had this great goal that they were going to begin broadcasting in stereo, and they believed that would be a selling point. What they hadn't anticipated is that almost no one had a stereo TV.
Right.
So on the night that they launched, they're sending out this stereo signal. And anyone who's listening on their mono TV, it just sounds like feedback.
Yeah.
It sounded probably like an Albert Eiler concert to most of the people who were at home.
Well, there's a reference to fairly out there jazz sax player in the midst of our discussion of rock and R&B and all the rest of it that appeared in the golden age of MTV. We've got calls, we've got comments, and that means a trip to the control room and producer Joel Meyer. Joel?
John, I have a listener in New Jersey writes this. I remember MTV because it put me out of a job. I worked with a rock and roll laser light show on Long Island. Once MTV was on the air, no one wanted to pay $7 an hour for an old seat in a drafty theater to watch what they could watch 24 hours a day on the couch. Now, Allison from Brooklyn posted this. MTV brought hip-hop to my family in the 80s when it was still much of a New York City culture. It also brought rock music to my African-American household, which was dominated by Earth, Wind & Fire and urban radio at the time. It helped to create my identity later in middle school and high school as I came of age in the late 90s.
Well, this is one of the videos that helped introduce the MTV audience to hip-hop.
School shopping. It was me, my brother, my mom, my pop, and my little sister all hopped in the car. We headed downtown to the Gallery Mall. My mom started bugging with the clothes she chose. I didn't say nothing at first. I just turned to my nose. She said, "What's wrong? This shirt costs $20. I said, "Mom, the shirt is plaid with a butterfly collar." The next half hour was the same.
DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. Parents just don't understand. What did parents make, Rob, of their kids suddenly spending hours on end in front of the television to watch these short-form music videos?
I'm sure that most of them didn't really understand what was going on, just like the Fresh Prince said. But they weren't supposed to get it. You know, the TV was for adults at that point. Almost everything that was on TV was either for adults or for children.
Right.
In the case of cartoons, there was really nothing for teenagers, and MTV created the teenage market.
Elizabeth is joining us on the line in Washington Heights. Elizabeth, were you a teenager in the early years?
Well, I guess so. I was in college, and I remember sitting at a friend's house. I guess this was 1981, and there were maybe 3-4 videos in rotation, and it was hilarious because we kept on watching pretty much the same thing, but we knew that it was going to be the beginning of something, or that it was the beginning of something that was going to be great. And, you know, now I have teenagers of my own who are in college and still watching MTV.
So they're watching MTV where? Because, Rob, MTV as we knew it in the 80s and very early 90s is no longer that MTV.
No, the turning point in our book is 1992. We define the golden age of music videos as starting in 1981, ending in 1992. That doesn't mean that there weren't great videos made throughout the 90s, but in 92, MTV began airing The Real World, and it was the biggest rating success they'd ever had, and it began their move away from music video programming to original programming, specifically reality TV
right.
programming that now has culminated in Snooki.
So were they the industry leader there? I mean, I guess there had been sort of pockets of quote-unquote reality stuff before, but as a format, were they pioneering again in 1992?
Absolutely. The Real World is the start of the reality TV onslaught. If you love reality TV, then you have The Real World to thank, and if not, then you have MTV to curse out. But originally, MTV, it wasn't a stroke of genius. They didn't think, oh yes, reality TV programming. What they really wanted to do was a soap opera. But when they realized how expensive a soap opera was, they said, "Well, we can't do this. We need to come up with something else."
Yeah, this after all is a channel that was built on other people spending often lavish
sure.
budgets to create their programming. I mean, that was a stroke of genius in
yeah,
a way.
There's a quote in the book from Steve Lukather, the guitar player in the band
Toto. Yeah.
And Lukather hated MTV. He says he hated making videos. He hated and resented MTV. And he talked about making videos and paying for them, sending them to MTV and them not getting on the air. And he said, "Why didn't I just take $50,000 out into my backyard and set it on fire?"
Well, there are a wide range of musicians responding and looking back at MTV, from from the Monkees, Michael Nesmith, through the guys in Toto, the guys from Duran Duran. It's a fun read. The book is called I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution by Craig Marks and Rob Tannenbaum. Rob's been with me here in the studio. And Rob, thanks so much for joining us once again on Soundcheck.
Good to see you, John. Thanks.
At the very end of MTV's golden era was the start of the grunge era with bands like this one, Nirvana. Still to come on Soundcheck, sax player Rudrish Mahanthappa draws on both American jazz and South Indian classical music in his works. He and his band will play live next. You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Rudrish Mahanthappa's roots are showing. Now, that might not be a good thing if we're talking about him dyeing his hair, but I'm actually talking about his recent musical projects. The sax player and composer grew up in Boulder, Colorado, with the sounds of American jazz. But his family's roots are in southern India, and that has colored his recent work. His latest album is called Samdhi, which means, among other things, twilight in Sanskrit. And the album's a seamless fusion of jazz, South Indian, and electronic music. Rudrish Mahanthappa leads his quartet here in our studio in a live performance of Killer here in the Soundcheck studio. We'll be right back. Killer is the name of the piece from Rudrish Mahanthapa and his quartet playing live on Soundcheck. Rudrish playing the sax, David Gilmore the electric guitar, Rich Brown playing the six-string electric bass, and Damian Reed behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. Killer appears on Rudrish Mahanthapa's most recent CD called Samdi, which follows up on some other recent projects, Rudrish, that you've done. First of all, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Nice to be here, John. Thanks for having us again.
You've done a couple of things that sort of incorporate your kind of family heritage with your own personal love of American jazz, the South Indian music and stuff. Let me ask you, growing up in Boulder, Colorado, how much Indian music did you actually hear?
Well, what I heard most was what my mom was playing for the most part, which was more the spiritual music, the bhajans, not so much music that's often heard in temples, not so much the Indian classical music. But there's a strong relationship between, I mean, Indian classical music is based on Hinduism. I mean, it comes from Hinduism.
You know?
So, yeah, it's not such a far stretch from one to the other. There's this kind of a, I mean, imagine the difference between American folk music and, you know, American classical music. It's, you know, there's a lot of similar material there, but it's not the same thing necessarily.
Right. Although you think of someone like Yo-Yo Ma, the great cellist who, you know, plays with bluegrass fiddlers and stuff like that as easily as he does with, you know, chamber musicians.
Absolutely.
So growing up in Boulder, Colorado, and we spent the first half of the show talking about MTV, did you want your MTV?
Maybe. You know, my parents probably didn't get cable TV until about 10 years ago. So I was stuck watching Friday Night Videos, which I think was on NBC.
Yeah.
And we did live in London in the early 80s, so I watched Top of the Pops for sure. And I think USA Network had a program called Night Tracks that I used to, you know, did get to see at a friend's house, along with MTV for that matter. But music video culture is not something I really grew up with. And all my friends did, so there was always a sense of, have you ever seen the video? Did you see that video? I said, no, but I know the song, you know.
So what were you listening to as a teenager in your formative years?
Well, at first I was really listening to, well, what I had access to, what was given to me, which was, you know, I think one of the first saxophone albums I ever had was a gift from a birthday present from a friend when I first started playing. And that was a Grover Washington Jr.'s Wine Light.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked that and went out and bought a few other Grover records. And actually, the first big concert I ever went to was to see a triple bill of Pieces of a Dream and Patrice Rushen and Grover. At Red Rocks. Actually, it rained out at Red Rocks, so it got moved. But that was an amazing show. That was kind of a life-changing thing. And, you know, the Yellow Jackets and the Brecker Brothers and David Sanborn, these were cassettes that I had. And my first saxophone teacher always brought recordings over, too. And eventually I, you know, heard Charlie Parker and Coltrane. But I was also listening to all the 80s rock on the radio,
sure.
And so, I think all of that kind of resonates in a sort of subconscious level. I think the music that you listen to when you're first learning to play music ends up having, even if you don't listen to it later on, it ends up having some sort of impact on kind of a subconscious level. And kind
How could it not? I mean,
you're
kind of forming your musical tastes as you're learning to play your instrument. And
those are also the things that inspire you to practice and to play. I mean, I heard the Brecker Brothers, Heavy Metal Bebop, I mean, you know, people have mixed feelings about that album, but just to hear the way Michael was playing, like, I wanted to play the saxophone that well. It wasn't a stylistic judgment at all. I just wanted to be good.
Well, when you mention people like the Brecker Brothers, the Yellow Jackets, David Sanborn, you know, that style of jazz has, you know, fallen out of fashion in a lot of jazz circles. The word fusion gets applied to a lot of that stuff.
Right.
What you're doing is a literal fusion.
I mean, I guess so. Yeah, sure. I mean, I just see it as I'm trying to put forth my identity as an Indian American. You know, I feel bicultural every minute of every day. And I feel Indian, I feel American, I feel neither, and I feel both. And I think, and that can vary from one second to the next. So that's what I'm trying to express through what I do. And that has evolved considerably over, you know, since I made my first album in 1995. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's taken various paths. And I think what's important to think about when we talk about that music, that quote-unquote fusion, jazz, rock fusion, whatever, you know, a lot of that music was coming out of soul and R&B, especially Grover. I mean, that right. was really important black music, mm-hmm. you know, and early Sanborn. That was instrumental R&B, instrumental soul. And somewhere along the course of the music, you know, the industry kind of sucked the soul element out of there, and it became this very formulaic kind of factory machine music that right. We all have ill feelings about, I think.
We're speaking with Rudrish Mahanthapa, the sax player and band leader. I want to ask you about Samdi in a moment, but you want to play another track for us?
Sure. You're
Playing with Stones is the name of this one, right?
Right.
All right, so once again, Rudrish Mahanthapa strapping on the old alto sax, and we'll hear David Gilmour playing the electric guitar, Rich Brown the electric bass, as I mentioned before, six string as opposed to the usual four, and Damian Reed playing the drums. The piece is called Playing with Stones. It's from the album Samdi, but it's another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. Thank you. That's called Playing with Stones. It's music from sax player and composer and bandleader Rudrish Mahanthapa and his quartet live on Soundcheck. They are playing at the Jazz Standard tonight, two sets at 7:30 and 9:30, and tomorrow night as well, and supporting a new album out called Samdhi, S-A-M-D-H-I. Rudrish, it's a Sanskrit word.
It is a Sanskrit word. It means twilight, but it also refers to the period between the destruction of one universe and the creation of the next. And I see both of those as metaphors for these kind of mysterious periods of time where certain things can combine and commingle that maybe can't otherwise. So, and I see that kind of duality or that combination of things happening in this group between the electric and the acoustic and between the South Asian and the and the jazz Western, or rock, the Western sensibility. And also I see it as the duality of everything I've done so far in my career kind of merging with the things that inspired me to play music at all. So,
but it's a beautiful album cover as well, really striking album art to go with this latest release from Rudrish Mahanthapa. It's called Samdhi, and Rudrish, always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for bringing in the band and playing for us.
Thanks for having us, John. It was a real pleasure.
This piece is called Breakfast, Lunch, and Dinner from the new album by Rudrish Mahanthapa. This is Soundcheck. That'll do it for Soundcheck today. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. The program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer, and I'm John Schaefer. Be with us again at this time next time for another Soundcheck.